Welcome, Street Brand. You're listening to Off the Wall on Swimming World Radio. Here are your hosts, Nathan and Felipe.
Welcome back, one and all, to Off the Wall on Swimming World Radio. I'm your host, Nathan Gendrick, joined by Felipe Delgado. We apologize for the delay in from our last show. We miss you. We hope you've missed us. Felipe, how have you been? It's been a while since we've been on
here. I've been great, man. I've been great. It's been a while. We've missed it, but we're back. That's all that matters.
Absolutely. We've got a lot to talk about today. There's lots to catch up on, lots of good topics. And later on, we will be speaking with swimming super agent Evan Morgenstein. He's one of my favorite people in the sport, never afraid to speak his mind, so I'm excited to talk to him and get his view on where the sport's at. We know just from looking at advertisements and things like that swimming is in a state of flux. We're not seeing nearly as many athletes being involved with apparel companies, and what the root cause of that is, where we're at, and will it be recovering anytime soon? All things we're going to talk to Evan about, and I have no doubt that he's going to be a great source of information. So we're looking forward to that. But Felipe, lots of other things going on. First thing that I want to talk about is there's been a rash of national age group records lately. There's been, particularly at the Tom Dolan Invitational that just finished up, there have been lots and lots of records broken by young kids. I mean, this is impressive to see the future of USA Swimming. Now, the question, of course, is why are kids so much faster? Why are these records being broken? And some of them aren't just broken. Some of them are being crushed. So we ask ourselves, where is this coming from? What are these kids doing? What kind of training is it taking? And that they're so much faster now than they were 10, 15, 20 years ago. And I was at this last weekend, there was the UFC on Fox that was on TV. It was actually held up here in Seattle at the Key Arena. So I took the opportunity to go visit my first live fight, and it was great. The production value was fantastic. In fact, it kind of reminded me with all the lights and things about our Olympic trials, which was kind of neat to see those things kind of contrast. But I was talking to a guy who runs his own MMA gym. And he was telling me that, you know, you get guys like BJ Penn, who is seen as like a legend in the sport. But his fight, I mean, unfortunately, and I'm a huge BJ Penn fan, but he got absolutely destroyed by a young kid who's, I think, 23 or 24, is a Canadian named Rory McDonald. And, you know, you talk about, well, how did that happen? We got this legend against this new, you know, young punk. What's the deal? And he made a good point. He said, you know, guys like BJ, when they came up, and guys like Matt Hughes and Randy Couture and the names that are really synonymous with MMA, they came up in a time when MMA was young and they got involved maybe late teens, early 20s, and they were really focusing on whatever sport, whatever martial art that they had just initially fell into or started with interest, whether that be Taekwondo, Jiu-Jitsu, whatever, what have you. And they did really well, and it was, you know, art against art, and they created some names for themselves, and they won some championships. Then, as this guy pointed out, you ended up with the guys who, they didn't start training in their 20s, they started training at 15, 16, and they started being more well-rounded. They started training in more than just one art. You know, maybe it wasn't just Taekwondo, but Taekwondo and boxing and Jiu-Jitsu, you know, they did some sort of ground fighting. And those are the guys that we're seeing coming up that are the champions now. Well, now we're seeing even some of those guys having a tough time hanging on to their titles. And what he's saying is now we're seeing the guys who started training at 10 years old instead of 16 years old, and they're being trained in all the arts because the coaches, their trainers, better understand what's needed to be successful in the fight game. And really, Felipe, you're a coach. You can give me your thoughts on this, but I think that a very similar thing is happening in swimming. We have kids that maybe in our sport aren't necessarily training younger than kids in the past have, but they're training more seriously younger and with a better grasp on what needs to be done to be successful, as our coaches as a whole are also more knowledgeable.
That's right. I think as our sport has evolved, and I've taken a look at this from many different angles. One is from the coaching perspective. The second one is from an entrepreneurship perspective. Because if you look at it from coaching, there are different techniques. There's a different mindset now when you coach an age grouper. I think that the mindset of ground and pound, when you just pretty much set them off to swim endless amount of laps. There's very little technique included, and it's just, let's see how much we can get, and the more yardage you can do, the better you are. I think what coaches have done now is they've fine-tuned it. That's one side. I think they've fine-tuned their approach to workouts. I think the other side of it is the cross-training. I think from a cross-training and a technology standpoint, we're so much more advanced in the sport now than we were, let's say, 10, 20 years back. And me being able to be a coach, I'm able to enjoy some of the things, giving some of the kids some of the things that we did not have, you know, as swimmers when we were growing up, some of the opportunities that we didn't have as swimmers, some of the things and knowledge that we have now that we didn't have before. And I think what's made a humongous difference in the results and the way our kids are swimming now is some of the cross training that we do. And again, swimming much smarter and training much smarter than we did 10, 20 years back. Historically, some of the bigger teams, although they have more talent on their team just because of the numbers, at this point, when you get into the higher echelon or the more elite level age group swimmers, you're not seeing those bigger teams win all of the events now. Now you're seeing a lot of the smaller teams win events. And in some cases, you're not even seeing the bigger teams win big swim meets anymore. You're seeing the smaller teams win swim meets because coaches are going to a more refined, smaller group, more quality group of swimmers versus taking in the hundreds and hundreds of kids where you might not get not even the quality in athlete, but not the quality in training either. So I think there's a lot of things that have changed within the last 10 years, let's say, that are making coaches a little bit smarter in their approach to training and giving kids more opportunity when it comes to some of the dryland stuff that they're exposed to and some of the training techniques that they're exposed to.
Right. Now, when we talk, you made the comment about the ground and pound, which is funny because that's also an MMA term.
That's right, yeah.
More than enough of that. I mean, you can't even count the number of tap out and affliction T-shirts that you see at a UFC fight. And of course, everybody's an expert.
Of course.
So you hear a lot of it. You know, which is fine. But you talk about the massive yardage that we used to see a lot of, and there are still, of course, are a lot of teams who really embrace that. I know lots of coaches who feel that you have to put in that kind of mileage when you're a young age group swimmer. Now, personally, I don't agree, but then again, I was never a good, very good age group swimmer, so who knows? And I've only, as a coach, worked with athletes in the teenage years and beyond. So I don't know necessarily from my own personal case studies whether that's the case, but from what I know about physiology and science and from the athletes that I have trained, I don't personally embrace that philosophy, but obviously for a number of athletes over many, many years, it has worked phenomenally well. But Felipe, as a coach yourself, you work with a diverse range of ages in swimmers. Tell me what makes swimming so different that this philosophy is embraced that you need such yardage. You know, we have athletes who train 100, 200, 400 yard swims. And of course we might get up to the 1650. But when it comes to the pool, really the majority of our events for athletes, of course, range between 100 and 200 yards. And yet we still have athletes out there who are swimming 10, 12, 14,000 a day to race 100 and 200 meter events. What makes swimming so unique that this is a perspective that feels is necessary? Because we have people out there who run marathons. I have friends who run very successfully with marathons, and you know, they'll be a top 50 finisher in the Boston Marathon, New York City Marathon. They don't run marathon distances in training except for very, very rarely. So they can go out there and perform well. And obviously running, of course, I'm just playing devil's advocate here because running is such a different sport. But we have sports like running or distance running where you don't even train at the distance in which you race. And yet we can have swimming where we'll have a 10,000-yard workout where athletes will do 15 repeats of 100 at race intensity. And that's just one set of what they're doing. And then come the weekend, they're going to swim a race that lasts, you know, what have you, 47 to 50 seconds or whatever. So what makes swimming, what's the mentality behind doing, you know, 10,000 yards in a workout to excel at a 100-yard event?
Well, I think swimming is catching up, because if you look at – and you nailed it on the head, because if you look at running, for instance, you got the marathoners. I have friends who are they do Ironman triathlons, and I have friends who just specifically do marathons. On their long days, they're going 18 miles.
Right.
Okay, so significantly less than what a marathon is considered, significantly less than what they're going to be running in an Ironman race. So why is it that our distance swimmers are going, like you said, 10,000, 12,000 meter workouts, when it seems like it's not justified? It seems as though it's not justified. Now, who am I to say that? Who am I to oppose a coach who's had a ton of success with swimmers, with distance swimmers? But I think, honestly, there is a new way, there's a new approach to distance swimming. There's a new approach to more specific specialty swimming, 50, 100, 200 swimmers. If you look at track and field, let's make track and field for example. If you look at the guys who run the 100, how often do they really run 100 in track? They don't. They run smaller, more intense sprints, weighed down, you know, they'll weigh down with the weight machines and stuff like that when they're running with the parachutes and whatnot, but they hardly get to run the 100. So why is it that coaches feel that if you swim the 100, you need to train 150, 200-yard events? I know that was my case growing up. If you swim the 50, if you swim the 100, we're going to train you as a 150 or a 200 swimmer, let's say, even though the 150 doesn't exist, you're going to be doing repeat 150s, because that's what you need to swim the 100. You need that endurance. You need that background. I think coaches are approaching it a little bit different now, and where we didn't have the skill or the knowledge base in the past as far as what happens on dry land, we have that now. And in a lot of cases, I think coaches are supplementing dry land work for what you do in the pool.
Right. Yeah, and that makes sense. I mean, you've got to find the right balance. And what I always tell the athletes that I work with, well, as far as my clients and training, whatever sport that they do, it's great to be well-rounded and functionally trained. So for the swimmers that I train, they all want to get involved in dryland stuff because they hear about, you know, what Michael Phelps does, or they see Ryan Lochte hitting a tire with a sledgehammer, and they see all these cool things. And like, well, you know, I may not be able to do that, but what kind of dryland can I do? What kind of things can I do on land? Well, and what I explain to them is you can't just recklessly exercise and assume that you're going to be better, because you can get stronger, you can become more flexible, but it has to become functional strength.
Correct.
I don't care if you can hit in the, you can go in the gym and you can raise your bench press from 135 pounds to 250 pounds. If that's not a functional type of strength that you can go take in the pool, it does absolutely nothing for you. In fact, you may have just created a significant amount of more muscle throughout your full body dry land training that is now sapping more oxygen from your blood and requiring a heavier oxygen concentration than you can actually make worthwhile in the pool. So, you know, there are certainly concerns that I think are being addressed now that have not in the past, like you're talking about. You know, we have a better understanding now, and again, it comes full circle. These are principles, and these are bits of knowledge that athletes are able to put to use sooner, and embrace, and they can use those for success later on. And I think that's why when we see all these national age group records, and we see that these phenomenal times from, you know, 6'4", 12-year-olds, or
yeah, I've seen
you
that.
Or 14-year-old, you know, female 200 breaststroke swimmers. I mean, I think we can understand where this is coming from. They're getting better training younger, and that's why we're seeing this next generation. So, yeah, I didn't think that I would learn or get any type of perspective at a UFC fight about swimming, but I think this just goes to show that sports and physiology tend to be universal. Intelligent training makes for success, simply where it's at. So it's good. I mean, it's kind of amazing because, you know, we have 14-year-olds now going times that I could have never imagined going when I was swimming, which in a way is kind of embarrassing, and in a way it's kind of just awe-inspiring. So,
yeah,
you know, but it's definitely a great thing to see. So
it's a lot of fun. It's a lot of fun to see. It's a lot of fun to be on the pool deck and be a coach and be able to experience that from a different perspective, because when you were an athlete, I don't think you took in so much as to what was going on around you. I think you were more focused on what you were swimming. You're more focused on doing well in your own events. You're more focused on your relays versus being focused on what else was going on around you. If I swam the 50 and the 100, I can tell you I didn't watch the 200 IM. I didn't watch the 200 back. I didn't watch the 200 breast. It just didn't interest me because I swam the 50 and the 100.
Right.
As a coach, you're watching everything, and like you said, it's awe-inspiring. Some of the things that these kids are doing now, some of the times that these kids are posting at such a young age, and again, I think a lot of that is refinement. I think a lot of that is the fine-tuning that the coaches are doing, and you're seeing that in the results at a much younger age.
Yeah, yeah, it's pretty phenomenal because if this is the first generation, like I said, you know, go back to it again. The guy that I was talking to, talking about the champions of today are the ones that started training, you know, a few years earlier than the champions of yesteryear. And now we have the next generation coming up that have been training even younger. It's amazing to think where our age group swimmers going to be 10 years from now when they're getting intelligent, appropriate training starting at age 7. You know, I mean, it's going to be pretty amazing to see how far that they can take it. At some point, there's a physical limit. But honestly, the way that we're seeing these jumps now, I don't think we're near it yet. And so it's going to be pretty, you know, it'll be pretty inspiring to see where this goes. But I'm sure we'll get some feedback from some coaches, maybe some who embrace a sprint philosophy and some who still embrace that distance philosophy. And again, you know, we're just playing devil's advocate here. Clearly, we support coaches who want the best for their swimmers and do what they feel is best, and the results speak for themselves. There has been success at people who go in and swim 90 minutes a day, 5 days a week, and there's been success at people who pound out the yardage seven days a week. So we're certainly not attacking any training philosophy. We just the idea here is to start some discussion on why coaches are doing what they're doing and why it's successful and what works for what type of swimmer. So if anyone out there in coaching land has some feedback, has some thoughts that they want to share, then we could possibly talk about it on the show. By all means, leave a comment at the link on swimmingworldmagazine.com under the show. Feel free to send an email. Whatever you need to do to get a hold of us, by all means, feel free to do that. Felipe, we'll move on now. There was a report that came out from FINA that says that there was over 500 doping tests taken in competition for aquatic events at the Olympics in London this year, and they all came back negative. Great news, right? But how many people actually believe that all of those athletes who got tested were really clean?
Well, I think there's always going to be some skepticism, and part of that is because people believe that the labs will always be a step ahead of the policing. So, yes, although it is very encouraging that we do have negative tests, and we did not have one positive come up, it's very encouraging. But what are we not testing for? I think that's what you need to look at, because if the labs continue to be a half step or a step ahead of the policing that's being done with the sport and the drug testing, I think you see what may not be tested for, what has not been tested for. And unfortunately, 5 years or 10 years from now when they do find out, and hopefully they do have some of these samples still available, they can go back and test them just like they have done in other sports and said, whoops, we missed that one. Yeah, this person was doing – you know, what we know about now 10 years later.
So. And this is why we need to get rid of the statute of limitations to take away medals. I mean, you get such condemning evidence, just such damning evidence of people like Lance Armstrong, for instance. And now you have the IOC having to explore legal options to whether or not they can take back his medal or not. I mean,
we live in a litigious society.
Which is so, absolutely ridiculous, yep. Because sport is a privilege, yep. Not a right. If you go out there and you earn a medal in the Olympic Games and you didn't deserve it, I don't care if it's 50 years later. Let's talk about the whole East German program.
Right.
I mean, clear and obvious. And if you're not able to take medals away from unscrupulous athletes, I mean, that's just a shame. I don't know who ever thought that it was a good idea to say, okay, well, after 8 years, we'll just not bother. That's absolute BS.
Right. And you're right. And, you know, living in a litigious society, there's always going to be a way around it. Unfortunately, you made reference to Lance Armstrong. I think you and I have talked about this offline, but unfortunately, they can't give anyone the yellow jersey that he gave up because everyone who behind him also tested positive. So They those should be vacant, which I think they are, the seven yellow jerseys that he won are vacant. But in most other cases, I think that's an extreme, but in most other cases, there are people who rightfully deserve to win those events. And
well, the problem that you have in like Lance's case, when you talk about the yellow jerseys, just to get on a cycling kick for a minute, the problem that you have with that is even before Lance, all this information came out and evidence against Lance Armstrong, you had people who had ridden with him who had tested positive. And that even in itself, just because of how strong the team aspect is in cycling, that became a problem. Because if one person who took the wind for Lance up one big giant mountain tested positive, well, you know, he got a performance benefit even if he hadn't been cheating. So that cycling certainly is in its own little world, and team sports in general, because one person cheating now casts a shadow upon everybody, even if the rest of the people had been clean. But in individual sports that you see in the Olympic Games, or swimming, for instance, one person goes out there and takes a medal from another person, and if they didn't deserve it, I don't care how far in the future you have to go. If you find out, make it right. And if you have to go down 10 spots to make it right because 9 other people tested positive too, well, you know what? Do it.
Right. That's correct.
So, it's sad. It's I'd love to have a more positive perspective on this, but I think the total number were 518 drug tests that were taken out amongst the five different aquatic sports, and they all came back negative. And somebody's in there. It's sheer numbers. It's unfortunate. You have too many people out there who are willing to do whatever they feel they need to do to win a medal. And as far as I'm concerned, you know, it's the wrong choice. And I don't want to say they're horrible people, but it'd be, you know, horrible decisions. And I'd love to believe that everybody was clean and wonderful, but, you know, it's just not realistic. I think because this information was in competition, we're not really learning much, because most athletes, as we found in positive tests in other sports, most athletes who are going to cheat, they're going to do it in the off season,
right?
Because they know they're not being targeted at that point. They know they have a lower risk of getting caught, and that's when you're really in the hard training and you use the drugs to try to get that leg up. What I'd like to see is a significant increase in the out of competition testing. Get rid of the loopholes for athletes to skip drug tests. And, of course, like I always come back with, if an athlete tries to give you a BS excuse that they tested positive because their caffeine prescription was contaminated, get rid of them too.
Yeah.
We're going to get some angry emails from that because people know who we're talking about.
Yeah, right.
Oh, well. So, on to some good news. Quick note, apparently the South African team that's going to be heading to, or on their way now, or I should say in Turkey now, for the Short Course World Championships, they originally, I guess, had to pay about $1,000 in American dollars out of their pockets so they could go to the event. Well, apparently, a couple months ago, Northwest University heard about this, and they decided that was something that they could get involved in, they could help out with. So I guess they sponsored the South African team somewhere close to $40,000 so that the athletes could get back the money that they had fronted to be able to go to this event. And Felipe, it's unfortunate, of course, that not all athletes competing in these types of events get their trip paid for by their NGB, but for those that do, this is really a feel-good story. We have somebody saying, or university in this case, saying, hey, we can help out, let's do it, and for a significant amount of money, too.
Well, welcome to the real world. I mean, we live in the United States, and everything is, everything is planned out. There's funds available. There's, it's just an easier, more defined, more automated process in the U.S. In a lot of other countries, it doesn't necessarily depend on the athletes that compete for your country. We all know South Africa has great athletes. We all know South Africa won gold medals at the Olympics this past summer in swimming. What we don't know are the politics that are behind the sport. And a lot of times the politics are so ugly behind these sports that it warrants a deeper look. And I know a lot of these governing bodies are trying to do the best for their athletes, and I know everybody has the best of intentions, but for some reason, it always ends up that the athletes are the ones that are shortchanged. South Africa is just one example of many. I come from a country, Ecuador, that was the case. Most of our international championships, we did not have funding until, in most cases, 3 to 5 days before the meet. Psychologically, what does that do to the swimmer? Instead of me worrying about my training and my eating and my sleep and my rest, I'm worried about more of, am I going to have to pay to get to wherever it is that I'm going? Or are my parents going to have to take this financial burden on? And I think, like I said, South Africa is just one example of what happens in the majority of international swimming, you know, for a lot of these countries. So it's unfortunate. What is fortunate is that somebody stepped up and said, you know what, this is wrong. And now we're talking about it, which is a great thing. You know, Swimming World Magazine has posted it. You know, we'll post it. That's going to be a great thing. It comes to light. And these governing bodies, they need to be held accountable, because a lot of times it's not for a lack of financing. It's more of a lack of leadership.
Right. Yeah, so absolutely. I mean, it's great to see these types of things. It's, in the U.S., obviously, the national team trips are paid for. And the issue here, as we've talked about many times on the show, is getting athletes to the point in which they can qualify as far as providing funding so that they can just train and actually try to perform at that level. And sometimes we think about that and as being this big issue. Well, how about, you know, these other countries where they even have to pay for their own trips to big events like you had to deal with? So certainly great to see somebody else stepping up and doing what they can to help out. So Felipe, one more thing we want to talk about. We're of course running short on time, but one more thing we want to talk about before we bring Evan Morgenstern on the show is, there was a few days ago, USA Today came out, and this is absolutely obnoxious, so if I start laughing in between here, you know, I apologize, but there was a story a few days ago that came out on USA Today. The title of the article: How Justin Bieber Almost Ruined Missy Franklin's Amateur Status, end quote. Now, I love Missy. Don't get me wrong. She's probably the sweetest person this sport has ever seen. Just fantastic human being. But the fact that she's a Justin Bieber fan, that was the first thing that I took away from this article. You just have to shake your head. So, no, I'm kidding. But the story goes on to talk about how Missy Franklin, because it came out that she was such a big Justin Bieber fan, received a care package after the Olympics from Justin Bieber, and it had things like CDs and posters and, I guess, T-shirts and stuff like that on it. And this apparently seemed like, oh, I don't know what exactly they called it, but some type of favoritism that would be deemed a gift and favoritism of whatever type, and it may have become an issue, as Missy Franklin told someone with ESPN, that it was considered a form of special treatment, and it could have put her eligibility for NCAA competition in jeopardy, so she sent it back. Now, I have to choose my words carefully, because while I certainly don't need to stay on the NCAA's good side, this is a family-friendly show, but this is just absurd. The NCAA, they make so much money treating athletes like professionals. The only difference is, instead of like an NFL team that has to pay the athletes, the NCAA gets to keep all the profits. And then they want to make an issue because some superstar pop kid sends a T-shirt to an Olympic gold medalist. Felipe, am I the only one seeing this? Is just absolutely absurd.
You know what would be cool? Let me tell you. This is what would be great, because the NCAA makes a ton of cash, as you said, and they make a ton of cash treating these athletes as professionals. But when it comes to these small situations, they have to lay the whip down and make sure that their lines are not crossed. You know what would be fun? If the national championship game, Alabama and Notre Dame, if the players decided not to play, how cool would that be if they just decided to put a stance up and say, you know what, we're not going to play this game. And we're not going to play this game because of the way the system is so unjust. this is one of those cases. Missy Franklin gets a care package from Justin Bieber, who could at this point probably somehow be considered kind of sort of a friend. And it'd be like you and I being, you know, athletes and I send you or you being an athlete and I send you a care package with, you know, food because of, as you know, college athletes are meant to, you know, we don't have a ton of money. So I send you and you can get in trouble for that, which you could because I'm gifting you. How ridiculous is that? When the NCAA, when the brass is making money hand over fist, but yet I send you a care package with maybe my signature and a T-shirt and a CD signed by me because I'm a, like you said, I'm a superstar, and that's considered something that could ultimately be damaging to your college career.
Right. Yeah, you know, Chris Chase, the one who wrote this initial article for USA Today, you can find it. It's dated December 5th. But I love the end paragraph here, and I'll read this again. This is from Chris Chase. The NCAA has no control over coaches leaving teams midseason, the college football bowl system, and teams switching conferences without regard for anything except dollar signs. But when it comes to making sure Missy Franklin can't wear a gifted Believe T-shirt, they operate with brilliant efficiency.
You got it.
And it's true. It's true. It's absolutely absurd.
You wonder where the inefficiency lies, right? You wonder where that lies, right? Because they're paying attention to the really important things. I mean, the efficiency that they have in making sure that Missy Franklin doesn't benefit from a T-shirt. But
Yeah. Well, and the thing is, Missy Franklin sent it back because apparently it came down that this was going to be some sort of issue. Well, once this hit USA Today, NCAA spokeswoman named Stacey Osborne came out and said, "We applaud Missy Franklin's commitment to amateurism, but Bieber fever is allowed under NCAA rules." Now, what they're saying is that it's okay that she got this stuff a little too late, given that she already sent it back. But because Justin Bieber has sent gifts to fans in the past, apparently it's not considered special treatment, so it's not a violation. Now, tell me, by that logic, does that mean that if, say, a booster for a college team gives things to more than one athlete, does that mean it's okay then? Because, hey, you're known to give gifts to athletes. So what that sounds like to me, because, well, again, I'm no legal scholar here, but what it sounds like to me is NCAA didn't like the bad press about America's sweetheart having to send back a T-shirt that they decided to come out a little too late and say it was okay. Does that sound about right?
That's correct. Yeah. And it's heartbreaking. I mean, it's because it's politics. It all goes down to politics again. Do you truly believe that she came out and said, "Hey, Bieber fever is not, you know, reprimanded by the NCAA"? Was she really saying that to say, "Hey, Missy, we're with you. You're a great athlete here"? No, she was saying that to make sure that they look like the good guys.
Yeah. Well, and you know what's amazing to me is just the way things have changed, and you still get little, you know, ridiculous issues like this coming up. But years ago, you couldn't even take, as an NCAA athlete, you couldn't take prize money from the Olympics.
Yeah.
Because that would have been considered, you know, being a professional athlete. Now you can be an NCAA athlete, and you can take prize money from, like, the Olympics, medal money. You can't, you know, obviously not the World Cup and whatnot. Missy, of course, had to give up a boatload of that. But for the Olympic Games, she was able to keep the medal money. And, you know, 10 years ago when my wife, for instance, was getting the national team stipend, you had to, you know, it was only like $500 at the time. I think now it's, you know, potentially $36,000 a year or whatever if you sign the agreement or whatever the partnership deal is. But nowadays you can do whatever you want with it and it's okay, even if you're involved in NCAA. Back when my wife, like I said, when she first started getting it was like $500 or something like that, you had to show receipts to ensure that it wouldn't affect your NCAA eligibility. So they were going to give you $500 if you can show you had that much in expenses. If you didn't have the receipts, you didn't get the money. So it's not like you could use it to pay, you know, when you're an athlete living at home, you can use it to pay rent or whatnot. So it was significantly more difficult to take support back then. Now they've opened up all these channels. You can take the medal money. You can just take the reimbursement. You don't have to worry about it. If you're a foreign athlete, you can, you know, compete. I think Cesar Cielo is a great example. You know, you could compete collegiately while making massive amounts of money back home because you're a superstar, but because you're competing in the United States and that's not where you're from, that's, you know, it was no problem. But American athletes can't do the same. it's hugely flawed. And I understand it's student athlete, not athlete student, and I get that. But what we're doing is seeing athletes leave the NCAA system because they want to be able to take advantage of making a living on a sport that they love and a career that they want to pursue. And you can't really blame athletes for that. But at the same time, you know, the NCAA is a money monster. They love money. They're all about making money. I would not believe for an instant the NCAA saying that they put the athletes first. Maybe there are certain individuals there that do that, and I don't doubt that. But as an organization, come on. It's all about money.
It's politics.
And, yeah, exactly. It's politics and money. So to me, it seems like, hey, the NCAA would do better for themselves, make more money for themselves, and put the athletes in a better environment if they set something up in which athletes could be remunerated in some way, at some level. I'm not saying let them go sign multi-million-dollar deals and still compete, but let them do something, get paid to an extent so that they can continue at the college level, represent their school, make the NCAA more money, help set themselves up for life, and continue to get an education so that when they leave college, if the sporting thing doesn't work out, then you know what? They have an education to fall back on. We see so many athletes in the big three sports leave college or don't go to college at all so that they can start making money. So they miss out on the educational opportunity, and then they go broke because they didn't know how to handle their money. What would have happened if we'd let these athletes make a little bit of money to support themselves or their families, which is the reason a lot of these guys go pro in the first place,
correct,
without going to college, to support their families. Let them make a little bit of money,
sure,
so they can support the families while getting an education,
sure,
and they'll stay in school. They'll make money. They'll support their families, which is the goal that they've set for themselves in life.
Sure.
The NCAA will make more money, and they'll be educated for when it's all over. That seems logical to me. What am I missing here?
That it's logical.
Now, why doesn't the NCAA is run by people with master's degrees and doctorate degrees? Why? Like, what's their stance against this? This is what I'm not getting. I'm apparently not educated enough to get their
side. It's bigger than us. It's bigger than us. You know what? It's the old guard. It's the way we've done business. And until something or someone stands up to the way we've done business, it will continue to be business as usual. We're talking about maybe a roundtable. And I've said this. Let's go back a few episodes ago when I made mention to always having an athlete member at the negotiating table,
right,
you know, and listening to their stories and hearing what it is that drives, you know, a potential superstar athlete to jump to the pro ranks earlier and giving up their education and saying maybe someday down the road I'll go get it. And, you know, that's never going to happen. So what is it? It's money. A lot of these athletes are coming from impoverished homes, impoverished backgrounds. A lot of these athletes are not coming from the best neighborhoods, but they happen to be the best athletes at the university. So everyone can benefit from that athlete staying in college. The university will benefit. The athlete will benefit with a great education. But monetarily, that's what matters. Once you start talking to me about monetary value, that's when I start listening. That's what the athlete that comes from less than desirable backgrounds will talk to you about. That's what they'll tell you. And if there is a way that we can do that, if there is a way that athletes can get compensated for their performances outside of the education, I get the education, but the education maybe down the road will pay the bills, but it's not going to pay the bills today. So maybe if we can talk a little bit about the monetary value of staying in college and the instant gratification of monetary value, then I think we'll have some of these athletes stick around and say, hey, you know what? I'm going to stick around. The education is important. I'm getting compensated for my performances on the field. And let's move forward with this. And you're going to see that more athletes would stay in college versus jumping to the pros. Because, you know, let's be honest, the only reason they're jumping to the pros is because of the potential for the cash payout. But
absolutely. Absolutely. I don't think that you're going to find a football player around who would rather get hit by a guy, you know, like Ray Lewis rather than a guy in college. I mean, you know,
yeah.
the level of competition is significantly higher. So I think if guys could hone their skills a couple of years longer so they could better play in the NFL and better match up, and make money along with it, provide for their family, set themselves up for life after sports, I think it's a no-brainer. But we have an NCAA system that doesn't support that because they're behind this just ridiculous guise of, oh, amateurism is the way to go. Well, if that were the case, then quit letting teams pay into the tens of millions of dollars just so they can switch conferences so they can get a better TV deal. You know,
all politics, it's all the bottom line, it's all the dollar value. But until somebody puts a firm stance and says, hey, enough is enough, you know, the athletes need to benefit as well as, you know, the NCAA, as well as the, you know, all of the negotiations, the contractual negotiations that go on. I think until somebody stands up and makes a pretty big deal out of it, it's always going to be business as usual. And I think at this point, something needs to be done, because a lot of these athletes, like you say, they don't look at the long term. And education can help you for the rest of your life. What you make in the NFL in the 3+ years that you could possibly be playing in the NFL, I promise you, for a lot of these athletes, won't last them but 5 years, if that.
Yeah. So we need people to bring attention to it, but I think, Felipe, what you're saying is that two guys running a swimming talk show aren't exactly going to get the big headlines.
No.
That this the topic needs. All right. Well, I think that's going to be the topic of my next column on swimworldmagazine.com. So if people want to get involved in the conversation, they can certainly write there, and I'm sure it's a topic that will come up again,
you know, but
right here on Off the Wall.
He might be able to do something about it.
We'll see. You know, always got to try.
Yeah.
Got to give it a go. It's certainly a cause worth fighting for. But we're out of time, Felipe. We are going to bring on our guest now. Again, swimming super agent, but he's beyond just the sport of swimming. He represents Olympic athletes and action sports athletes that include gymnast Dominique Dawes, volleyball player Phil Dahlhauser. He represents legends in the sport of swimming, such as Mark Spitz, Josh Davis, Rowdy Gaines, Derek Torres, Amanda Beard, on and on and on. He is one of the deal makers in this sport. We are now welcoming to the show Evan Morgenstein. Evan, thank you very much for joining us.
My pleasure, Nathan.
Evan, you work with some of the biggest names in our sport. Of course, legends like Derek Torres and Mark Spitz, but of course, athletes these days in London. We've got Cullen Jones. You work with so many athletes that I'd say the vast majority of deals that swimmers get come because of the work that you do. Now, before we get into specifics, can you give us just a general idea right now of how the market is for swimmers?
Oh, it's terrible. I mean, if you're a swimmer looking to make this a career, there couldn't be a worse time to do it. You know, unfortunately, when the thieves at FINA made a decision that they were going to get rid of the big suits, what they did was they almost bankrupted several of the swimwear companies, and they've never recovered from that because they were so vested in that. But they actually hurt the sport and hurt the popularity of the sport. People love Olympic sports like swimming because of world records. And although there were a couple of world records broken in London, comparative to Beijing, there was virtually no records broken. And that's a shame. Technology changes in every other sport. You know, I know there's people that want to go back to the 1950s. They love going to, you know, drive-in movies. You know, the past is great. But the fact is, when it comes to technology, you can't stop. You have to keep moving forward. And this isn't cheating, right? This isn't, you know, the Lance Armstrongs of the world. This is technology and shoes, rackets, whatever, changes in every sport. Yet FINA singularly changed the sport. And then once that happened, the apparel companies had millions of dollars of inventory they couldn't sell. So what happened? They stopped signing athletes because they said, well, unless you're the biggest of big or we already have you under contract, there's no reason for us to sign new athletes. So many athletes, even athletes with Olympic medals, didn't get apparel deals this time around. It's just absolutely a shame.
Now, of course, you were known for scoring Cullen Jones that huge deal with Nike, and now they're out of the swimming market, at least when it comes to those high-margin tech suits. But as far as players in the apparel game went, how much did losing Nike alone hurt swimming?
Oh, it was devastating. It was devastating because of two reasons. One, Nike paid some of the highest fees of any company because that's, you know, what Nike does. If they want somebody, they will pay what they have to, and I've always had respect for that because their valuation on talent is just different than everybody else's. But number two, there's no leverage. I mean, so you have Speedo and Arena signing people, very few people, and then you've got everybody else signing maybe one or two a year, max. So that just guts the marketplace because, you know, Arena is building their brand back up in the U.S., and they've had several American swimmers. A number of them are mine, like Eric Chanteau and Aaron Pearsall, and they've got Rebecca Soni and Janet Evans, but they don't have a ton of athletes. And Speedo has made a decision that, for the most part, they're going to go after the biggest of bigs. And then there's this other monolith that's sort of looming over the apparel industry, you know, which is Missy Franklin. So every apparel company will tell you that they want to see if they can set themselves up to sign Missy. But what's that going to take? And that does affect the companies. Even though she went to college, there aren't many people in the business that think she's going to 4 years to college. And because of that, they're saying, well, maybe 2014 or 15. And how are we going to budget accordingly so she, you know, they can pay her the money that she needs to sign with them? So there's all these factors that most people don't think about that are affecting the valuation and opportunity, you know, in the marketplace for them to be able to actually earn a living.
Well, you brought up Missy Franklin, and that was some questions I had for you pertaining to her were on my docket here for a little bit later. But since you mentioned her, let's go ahead and talk about her. First, before we get into what her potential is, even in the market, which, as you say, is awful right now, from your professional opinion, how much, if you had to target it, do you think someone in your position could have netted someone like her after the kind of performance that she had in London?
Well, look, I had this conversation with many people, which is I think she would have been worth more prior to the Olympics than post-Olympics. Because the Olympic sponsors, although I think she probably would have had a lot of companies interested in signing her and having her for 4 years, the reality is that the hype of a Summer Olympics is more valuable than the post-Olympic payout. I mean, just look right now. If you could name five athletes that have signed endorsements since the end of the Olympics in swimming, I'd give you a buck. Because you can't. You can't name five swimmers that have scored endorsement deals since the Olympics.
But with someone like Missy, what do you think? If you had to target a dollar, are we talking, did she miss out on $1 million, $2 million, $5 million?
Oh, I mean, look, the apparel companies. See, here's the thing. The apparel companies know where they are. You know, before the suits went away, she would have been worth $1 million a year just in a swimwear deal. Since the suits went away, it's going to be some lower subset of that. You know, the other thing is, people are nervous. You know, long-term contracts, you know, the contracts like a Katie Hoff got or a Ryan Lochte got, you know, these deals that will go over two or three Olympic Games, you know, that makes companies very nervous, very nervous, because anything can happen. I mean, you just don't know. You know
are
what
you
mean?
Seeing that? Is there any interest? We saw Mark Gangloff, for example. He ended up signing a bit of a unique deal with a company like Swim Outlet. Are you thinking that perhaps working with sales companies like that might be the new frontier, or do you think that is like a one-off thing and isn't something that athletes can expect to be a part of in the future?
Yeah, Swim Outlet is just an animal to itself, and how they do business and what their focus seems to change on a regular basis. Are they focusing on their own swimwear brand? Are they focusing on building out other people's swimwear brands? Are they, you know, looking to support swimmers? Are they looking to leverage swimmers' relationships with existing swimwear companies? It's all over the place. I don't look at Swim Outlet as a bastion for opportunity with athletes. They've done some stuff. We've never done anything with them. But, you know, they've done some stuff with athletes. So I would say that that's not going to fill the void. Look, quite candidly, nothing's going to fill the void. The only way that the void would be filled is if USA Swimming, like the NBA, signed deals where a percentage of revenue they generate per deals goes back to athlete programs. That's how it works in the NBA. A certain percentage of the rev that comes in from each sponsorship is then spent against athlete programs. So, but that's never going to happen because they don't have the strength to tell their sponsors what to spend money on.
Right. Now, Evan, you've of course been known as a huge advocate to your athletes. There's certainly been no secret about that. It's been well covered, especially in the lead up to the Olympics. Now, something that I pulled from the internet before you and I got on the line. A SportingNews.com article from July had retold the story of you having a few adult beverages at a Hilton bar in Dallas during a media summit, and you had made some comments, it mentions, about the USOC's, in your opinion, exploitation of athletes, and apparently it was to some people who worked for them. You, in the same article, were also called the most polarizing figure in the Olympic business, and you're quoted in that piece also as having described swimmers as indentured servants. Now, this is back in July, post-London, seeing where athletes are, seeing what USA Swimming, what their stance is these days. Has your opinion since then changed at all?
Well, of course not. What's changed? Nothing has changed for the Olympic athlete, the condition of the Olympic athlete. In fact, I just signed 5 winter athletes, and I'm starting to read athlete agreements that the federation or these athletes are signing and what they're being required to do in terms of giving up marketing rights. And I'm absolutely positive that these are all violations of the Ted Stevens Amateur Sports Act, which, by the way, is an antiquated document and needs to go away. It's unfortunate that Ted died in a plane accident in Alaska. But, you know, unfortunately, you know, the people that are keeping this act alive in memory of Ted are doing the athletes no favors. So the reality is that the system is broke. The analogy I make to everybody is this. That think about any NGB. You've got the best athletes in the world. So take Major League Baseball. But as part of the management of Major League Baseball, the organizing group is also taking care of Little League. So the analogy is that Little League Baseball is running MLB. Would that ever work? Of course not, but that's the way it works in the Olympic movement. The minor leagues are running the major leagues, and the major leagues are meant to feel like they somehow owe something because they take up a majority of the budgets of the governing bodies. Well, unfortunately, the governing bodies have sponsorships mostly because of the national team. Now, sure, big sports like swimming and gymnastics, you know, have hundreds of thousands of kids, but when it comes right down to it, you can leverage hundreds of thousands of kids in lots of ways. You sign on with an NGB because they have elite athletes and you want the association with their success.
Right. Now, you talk about reading these agreements and giving up rights. Between that and what you know in your professional opinion, what do you see as the limiting factors preventing swimming from going more mainstream and getting more sponsorship dollars down to the athletes? Now, whether that's the NGB, FINA, NBC who broadcast the Olympics, or even the athletes themselves, what do you see as the biggest problem that we have from letting our athletes make money of the sport?
Well, there is no specific problem. I mean, there's a limitation. NBC is in business for NBC. I mean, they are clearly out there for one purpose and one purpose only, to sell advertising opportunities. So they don't care about the athletes. I mean, look, you know, all these organizations, they're all, you know, the greed is rampant in the Olympic movement. They always blame the agent. The agent's so greedy. It's such baloney. The fact is, the things that I'm fighting for and the things that I've spent my career fighting for and the things that I continue to put my company at risk to fight on behalf of the athletes for are things that I never make a dime on. So if the athletes make $5,000 a year versus the paltry, you know, revenue that they make in the sport of swimming now, well, guess what? I don't make any commission on that. If the USOC triples the bonus that they pay for Olympic medals, I don't make any money on that. If there's a stipend that's generated from the billions that are made by the IOC, I don't make any money on that. If there's a true split of television revenue, as I've called for, like in all the major sports, at a level of 50 to 55% of total revenues towards the athletes, I don't make any of that. So it's great that everybody calls me a dirty, you know, money-grubbing bum, but when it comes right down to it, the things I fight for and the things I spend money on and the things that I spend money on with my attorneys, I don't even make any money on. So I sleep well at night because I know that my hands are clean in this thing. I know where the bad guys are, and I don't feel like I'm one of them, although it's easy to point the finger at me. Why can't you just shut up and let things happen the way they happen? I'm just not comfortable with that. You know, it's not okay with the status quo when people are basically dedicating their lives, you know, to the fulfillment of their dreams and goals of winning a gold medal. And as soon as they're done, the day they're done, they have no insurance, right? They have nothing. It's a pat on the back and thanks very much, and we'll replace you on the team. It's insane.
Now, there's been a lot of talk, of course, on the internet. People, you know, everyone, keyboard warriors got an opinion about everything, and some are great and some are not so great. But one that's kind of recurring is the idea of a, whether it's the right term or not, a union, where the best mm-hmm. of the best get together, the athletes get together and say, hey, we want a fair shake at this. We're making USA Swimming all the money. We're making the USOC. We're making NBC the money. Everyone says, well, why don't the athletes just do that? What are your thoughts on that, on why it's not being done, and would it work?
It'll never work. It's a great try. I appreciate what the track athletes are doing. It's never going to work. Here's why it's never going to work. First and foremost, you can't have a union because the athletes are independent contractors. So a union for what? You can't form a union if you're not employees of somebody. You're independent contractors. You can form an association of some sort, but you can't form a true union, and therefore you're not protected under the laws of the country. That's the first thing. The second thing is, it's the problem of the athletes. Look, I've been doing this forever, and I can't tell you how many athletes that I've had conversations with about what we need to do, and everybody should say no to the athlete agreements, and when it comes right down to it, unfortunately, the saddest part of what I've ever done in this business is there are too many athletes that are sheep, and they just get herded. And the other part of it is, which is really sad, is that if you had an athlete that's willing to risk their career in swimming and say, no, I am not going to accept this. This is not okay. I think the conditions of how the athletes are treated are not okay. And I'm going to stand shoulder to shoulder with the fencers, the archers, the table tennis players. Well, see, what happens in the NFL, as an example, the reason why they stand shoulder to shoulder and don't break lines is because you never know. You may end up on a team with a bunch of the guys that stood on that picket line you crossed. Not a good place. If you're in the Olympics, when are you ever going to see a tennis table player? When are you ever going to see an archer? When are you ever going to see a team handball player? So the reality is that there's no shared experience. And the other thing is, if you're one of the top three sports, swimming, gymnastics, and track, you certainly feel like you're worth more. So if they're ever going to divvy up the pie, you want more. Why do you want more? Because the TV ratings are greater. Well, if you're an athlete that dedicated the same amount of time to make sure that you can play the best ping pong in the world, you're going to say, the hell with that. I'm just as equal as them because my gold medal looks just like theirs. So therein lies the absolute problem. And here's the thing. The USOC knows it. The IOC knows it. That's why they just continue to go down the path they go down, because they really don't feel that there's any threat to anything that they're doing.
Right. Now, I think you've already answered this, but just to hit it on the head specifically, we have so many great athletes in the sport, so many gold medalists, obviously with swimming being one of the lion's share of Team USA's Olympic medal count. You have household names, lots of familiar names. They're not necessarily making any money, but household names. Now still, because of that type of recognition, when athletes retire from swimming, even if this was a better economy, now you have athletes like Dara Torres and Ryder Gaines, legends of the sport. They've built their brands. But for other Olympians, even individual gold medalists, even in a better economy, do you think it's even reality that these people can go from being on top of the sport to building a business and a life out of it later on?
No, very few people can actually continue to earn at the level they earned while they were competitively swimming with what they are going to earn post-swimming. Very few. Just doesn't work that way. You know, because there's a – and by the way, that's not an Olympic issue. That's a reality, because in the world of celebrity, right, because if you're an athlete, an elite athlete, you're a celebrity at whatever level, the people that get paid most are the ones that are the most relevant to society and to corporate America. So if you lack relevancy because you're just not out there as much as you were before, even in a different capacity, your valuation is going to go down. Less people are going to want to see you. Less companies are going to work with you. That's a natural core of things. But look, if you look at a client like Mark Spitz or Bruce Jenner, who have been out of their sport for decades, they continue to earn six and some years, seven figures. Forget about TV shows and anything like that, just in terms of speaking and endorsements, because they actually built their brands at a time where there were three channels, there was two wire services, and everybody paid attention to the Olympics. Now, I tell people all the time, You know, Michael Phelps could win 10 gold medals, and unfortunately half of America is watching Extreme Makeover, you know, Household Edition. I mean, it's just a different world that we live in. There's many, many more choices for information and what you spend your time on. So it's hard to build icons. Michael Phelps is an icon. He will endure the test of time. Will Ryan Lochte? I don't know. You know, there are a lot of athletes out there. Will Natalie Coughlin? I don't know. But Michael absolutely will. He's the one athlete you can guarantee that will endure beyond, you know, this Olympics, the next Olympics, and the ones beyond that, because nobody's ever going to win more medals than he's won.
Right. Now, Evan, I know you've got to get going, so I just have one last question for you. We would love to think that swimming could one day get to even a quarter of the publicity and revenue that one of the big three sports get. Now, whether that'll ever happen, that's up to certain individuals. But you, as anyone knows, the bigger a sports gets, the more that can hopefully filter down to the athletes. Now, let's put you in the shoes of the let's say you're in Chuck Wilgus' shoes. Let's say you're running USA Swimming to move the sport forward, to make everybody more money, from the teams to the athletes, all the way up the NGB. If you were in charge, what changes would you make to move this sport forward?
Well, there's only one way to do it, and the unfortunate part of what needs to be done is that it's never going to happen. And what needs to happen is there needs to be a true partnership. See, what everybody's afraid of in the Olympic movement, by the way, I love Chuck, and I think Chuck does an unbelievable job, and swimming's the best-run sport in the Olympics, and I still would love a million other things to be done, and Chuck knows it because we've talked about it. But if there's any way to create more value, more money, more opportunity for both the sport and the athletes, you have to get rid of these silly athlete agreements. They're just ridiculous. You have to have a true partnership. So if you are going to company X, Y, and Z, Procter & Gamble, Johnson & Johnson, Coca-Cola, Pepsi, whomever it is, whatever the company is, and you said that you had the support of majority, if not all, of your national team, and they were going to be included in whatever deal you did, what would the deal look like? If you're asking now for $250,000 to $500,000 and you have no access to athletes whatsoever, but a deal is being delivered with literally 25 of the best athletes in the world that you're going to get social assets from, you're going to get appearances, trade shows, you're going to get the ability to utilize them online or advertising, marketing, TV campaign, what would that deal look like? If you truly were interested in the sport of swimming, that may be a $2, $3, $4 million deal. I mean, then you've got some significant cash. Now you've got deals that are going to be substantially higher. And the truth is, then there becomes a partnership. The problem is, the reason why partnerships don't create themselves like that, it's about control. Control and greed. How can I control what, you know, the money coming in? How do I allocate it where I want to allocate it? And that's unfortunately how that works. I mean, look at deals like BMW. BMW is a great sponsor. They do a great job with certain athletes. And then they offer other Olympic athletes $500 to go do a appearance at a dealership. Well, that's nice, except for Olympic gold medalists are actually accepting $500 to do appearances at dealerships. I find that just absolutely absurd. The valuation of Olympic gold medal has to be more than $500. It's not BMW's fault. They're doing what they're supposed to do. I don't fault them at all. I think the system's terrible. I think the athletes should hold out for more money. But I think BMW does a phenomenal job marketing. They do great campaigns. I just think that, you know, companies have to recognize that people can't sustain their careers on $500 appearances. And, you know, I've talked to apparel companies recently, and they want to offer athletes, bonuses on performance only. And I said, why bother? You know, if you want to bleed an athlete to death, if you want an athlete to not perform, don't give them any money. It's simple. If you want athletes to leave the sport, continue not to pay them. If you want the best athletes in the world, then pay them, and pay them like they should be paid. Or otherwise, you know what? Maybe London was the last Olympics we saw that many Americans at the top of the medal stand. There's always going to be the Missy Franklins, but what do you do about all those other athletes who aren't making significant money? Are they going to get out, and now are we going to leave, you know, the Olympic gold medal dreams to a lot of athletes that maybe aren't ready to perform at that level, but they can do it because they're in college or high school? I hate to see that, but if they want to get rid of the professional athlete, boy, they're going the right direction.
Yeah, it's funny you mentioned the offers for the $500 and less appearances. We get some of those letters at my house.
I bet.
We make the same comments.
Right.
Yeah, and you're right. It is because these companies are realizing, hey, nobody else is offering anything. So if we offer something, well, you know what they say, 100% of something is better than, or you know, half of something is better than 100% of nothing. So
exactly.
It's unfortunate, but Evan, I know you got to run. I just want to thank you so much for your time, for your insight. It's definitely something that every swim fan at least has an idea or an opinion on, and I think having you on the show really lets people know the straits that our professional athletes are in, because there's this perception that, oh, Olympic gold medalist must be a millionaire. Unfortunately, that is far from the truth. So, Evan, again, thank you so much for joining us, and we wish you and your athletes absolutely the best going forward.
Thanks, Nathan. Great talking to you.
That was Evan again. Thank you so much for your time, Evan. We appreciate his thoughts on so much going on in the sport, and hopefully we'll be able to get him back on the show in the future when we see the economy hopefully improve in the near future. That's our show for the day, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you so much for joining us. We appreciate having you. Of course, if you want to get involved in the conversation, if you have anything on your mind, by all means, leave a comment in the show link on swimworldmagazine.com or swimworldtv. Again, you can also email us as well if that's more convenient for you. Until the next time, thanks for joining us.